Hello and welcome to What is X with your regular host, Justin E.H. Smith. As many listeners will know by now, on each episode, I have on a guest and we explore some fundamental X, where that variable stands for a concept that is usually difficult to define, often of interest to philosophers, and we seek together to come to a shared definition by the end of the episode. If we're unable to, then we end in disagreement or perhaps aporia, but we always hope to find a way to agree. And today we are going to be talking about what I take to be one of the most difficult X's of all, which is consciousness, with my guest, Professor Eric Schwitzgebel, who teaches philosophy at the University of California, Riverside, and is the author of many books, most recently a book called A Theory of Jerks and Other Philosophical Misadventures. And I'm sorry we can't talk about that today, but maybe it will come up as well. So thanks for coming, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, let's try to work our way into the question of consciousness. And at the outset, I should confess that I'm ready to be persuaded. This is one of the topics where I feel almost as clueless as if I were in an introduction to philosophy course some decades ago. I don't feel like I myself have made any progress, whether the philosophy of consciousness as a field has made any progress. Do you think it has?
I think it has made progress, but I think that the people who have made the most progress overestimate how much progress they've made. But it's certainly blossomed in the last couple decades after, being relatively quiet in philosophy and cognitive science through a lot of the later part of the 20th century.
Do you think, what was the key moment in that? I think of David Chalmers' book in the mid-1990s as opening up a renaissance in the philosophy of consciousness that has been continuing ever since. But I'm a relative outsider to this field. Is that correct in your view?
I think that's an important part of it. I think also slightly earlier in the 90s, Dennett's Consciousness Explained and Searle's Reconsidering the Mind also really kind of got a lot of attention and opened up discussion of consciousness. But I do think that Chalmers's The Conscious Mind in 1996 had a special impact because he was defending an unorthodox view, right? So the orthodox view in the latter half of the 20th century among, Anglophone philosophers of mind was materialism, the idea that all there is in the world is material stuff and everything about us has to be basically biological, physiochemical, all explainable in terms of the natural sciences. And The Conscious Mind is a brilliant book that disagrees with that. And Chalmers argues so well and so tightly that it constituted a really important challenge to the materialist orthodoxy. And I think that really further energized the field.
Again, I want to focus on your views more than on Chalmers's, but just to see if I have it straight, am I correct in thinking that he doesn't argue for a straightforwardly anti-materialist view, but rather holds that there may be a future science of consciousness that will come to maturity, but neuroscience is not it. And in that respect, the stuff of consciousness may be some other stuff of nature that we haven't succeeded in detecting yet. And people are simply wrong to suppose that mapping neural activity and getting ever more fine-grained correlations between that neural activity and what we experience as inner states is ever going to explain to us how those correlations work. So it's in that sense that neuroscience can't be the science of consciousness, but nonetheless, the future science of consciousness could be a perfectly naturalistic one. Is that Chalmers's view, or am I misreading or misremembering?
I think that's not how I would put it exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. I think it depends on how you conceive of science. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So if you think of science as fundamentally about studying the structural and physical and functional interactions among things like particles, mm-hmm. Then you'll never get, on Chalmers's view, an explanation of consciousness right. that way, right? So to the extent you think of naturalistic science as about, you know, this structure is shaped like this and moves like this mm-hmm. and interacts in this way with these other structures, mm-hmm. that kind of story is never going to get you an answer to the question of consciousness. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he doesn't think it's a supernatural phenomenon
right.
in the way that, say, a religious dualist might think.
Right.
Right. He's still at root pretty naturalistic in his inclinations.
Right. Right. Right.
He does think that explanations, the standard way that we think of scientific explanations, will never kind of get us across the bridge to consciousness.
Right. Right. Now, in the materialism that reigned for most of the 20th century and that kind of prevented philosophy of consciousness from flourishing, it was supposed, I gather, that to acknowledge consciousness as something in the world is some kind of vestige of earlier not yet fully naturalistic beliefs, right? To even acknowledge consciousness is something like holding on to the idea of an immaterial soul, right? That was a kind of tendency in the 20th century. And I suppose still is if you look at people like the Churchlands, right?
Yes, I think there was that tendency. I think it was associated, the idea of consciousness was associated with the religious traditions, and it was associated with anti-materialism, unscientific traditions, or to the extent it was, you know, approached scientifically in psychology in the mm-hmm. early 20th century and late 19th century, the introspective psychology movement, it was seen as methodologically suspect, not hard science,
right?
All depending on people's introspective reports. But what we really should be doing is measuring their behavior,
right?
So it seemed kind of fluffy and, you know, suspect.
Right. Do you see any legitimate reason to hold on to that suspicion? I mean, is there a problem in that consciousness is by definition something that we experience alone, whereas science should study something that we can point to together outside of us and say, that's the thing?
Right. Well, I don't think science should be limited to in such a way that we couldn't count introspective reports ever. Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think that the study of consciousness depends essentially upon people's introspective reports, their own judgments about their stream of experience mm-hmm. that are in some sense private. Although mm-hmm. what exactly we mean by private here and all that is complicated. But and those are, I think, those kinds of judgments are much less secure than people have often thought. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you go back to Augustine and Descartes, lots of people in the early modern tradition, they thought that you had very secure knowledge of your stream of experience, your consciousness, using modern contemporary current terms. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I think that came out in the early 20th century was that people really are not so good in their introspective reporting, even of the stuff sometimes it seems most obvious to them. So a science of consciousness is going to have to rely on that stuff, but that kind of reporting, has a lot of problems. So that's part of what makes the science of consciousness difficult, I think.
It sounds like we're already quite early on in this conversation starting to isolate the concept in question. You mentioned these developments in the 20th century that complicated what had earlier looked to early modern figures like a straightforward, transparent notion, consciousness. What were these complexifying factors in the early 20th century? I'm thinking of a couple of things, maybe experiments in experimental psychology that showed that people often give different reports about what they're perceiving than what they're actually perceiving, and all sorts of strange effects were being discovered there, but also the discovery, if you want to call it that, of the subconscious in, say, the Freudian tradition, where we're, so to speak, mysteries to ourselves. And if we're mysteries to ourselves, then first person reports aren't worth that much, right? But what did you have? What did you have in mind?
I do think that the Freudian and psychoanalytic tradition is important there, but even more central to my thinking is the early introspective psychologists, people like Wilhelm Wundt, often treated as the founder of scientific psychology, and E.B. Titchener. They were very interested in the scientific introspective reporting of experiences, especially sensory experiences. And what they found was that people gave very different and unstable reports about their experiences, even when it was plausible that their experiences weren't that different. The most famous example of this is the imageless thought debate. So some people, especially in Germany, Oswald Kupa and others, thought that you could have a thought without any imagery. You could have a specific content, but you don't have any visual imagery or any auditory imagery. If we think of auditory imagery, it's like silent tunes in your head or silent words you say to yourself, or any other kind of imagery in any sensory modality. You could just think something like, Darwin is, they had some fancy example, some famous fancy example using Darwin, and I forget exactly what.
But this would be stuff like with the propositional content, right?
Propositional content. Yeah. Let me give you another example from much later, because this about a century later, you get an echo in the Anglophone philosophy tradition, right? Mm-hmm. Charles Siewert has this wonderful example. So Charles Siewert's a philosopher, is briefly a colleague of mine here, but in his 1998 book, The Significance of Consciousness, he has this wonderful example where he is walking from a table in a restaurant to pay the cashier. Mm-hmm. And, maybe it's 6 steps or 14 steps he has to take. Mm-hmm. Right from the table to the cashier. And he's been thinking about the imageless thought debate. And he's been thinking, and he also recently had a child. And in the course of this stepping from the table to the cashier, he thinks to himself something, I think I'm going to get the content pretty close, but maybe not exactly right. Something like, now that I've been thinking a lot about imageless thought and the possibility of having thoughts that kind of don't track down into sensory phenomenology, it seems suddenly like the world is full of examples of this. And that's like when I had a baby, suddenly the world seemed to be burgeoning with babies in a way it hadn't before. But of course, the world had the same number of babies
before.
So oh, that's a pretty sophisticated, complex thought, right, to have in a few steps between the table and the cashier. Right.
Yeah.
And he says, and it seems plausible, right? It's not like there was this long sentence in his head that expressed that exactly in words.
Yeah.
And it's not like he had this picture of burgeoning babies, you know, it's just like he had this.
Yeah.
It's plausible.
Yeah.
He had this thought that couldn't really be reduced to, you know, images or sentences in your head.
Yeah. I don't know. But when you're talking to me about that, it's like, I get what you're saying. But for some reason, I also picture a restaurant, and I could describe the restaurant. It looks kind of like an Olive Garden, and and I see a bunch of babies like all over the tables and in the booths.
Right.
And it's like it's as if my imagination just has to fill in the thought about the propositional content you're giving me with something, right? I remain skeptical. I think everything is a compliment. I don't know. The jury's out for me.
Right. And for me too, actually. So the debate here, to get a little more nuanced about Siewert's example, is, okay, so let's say you do have, say, a visual image while I'm telling you this. Right? Mm-hmm. And maybe Siewert had an image of a baby too, right? So the question is whether that image captures or exhausts the content of the thought,
mm-hmm.
right? So you could have, you know, in the later tradition, it gets called cognitive phenomenology, right? So you could have this cognitive phenomenology and also an image that's related to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the cognition, the thought, it's kind of, you know, the image is attached to it. The image isn't really doing the kind of cognitive work.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't like take a brainoscope, look at what your image is and say, ah, this is what the thought is.
Right.
So historically, back in the early 20th century too, psychologists argue about this, right? So Kulpa, for example, you know, said you could have these imageless thoughts. Titchener said you couldn't, right? That thoughts are always accompanied by and constituted by imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked their own expert introspectors what they thought, and the introspectors agreed, right? So the Americans tended to think that, you know, all conscious thought could be exhausted in terms of the images, and the German introspectors thought no, right? So that was kind of one famous dispute, right? Mm-hmm. Where it seemed like the introspective task was difficult.
Yeah.
Right. And so people could get it wrong. Right. So the Americans thought the Germans were getting it wrong, and the Germans thought the Americans were getting it wrong. And both of them said, well, look, you know, you have to be expert. You have to be careful.
Yeah.
You got to be trained and not make certain mistakes.
Yeah. Right.
Like Kulpa would have said that what you just said was a mistake that a non-expert who wasn't aware of the distinction, wasn't thinking carefully about the distinction between, right, the thought itself and the image that accompanies the thought could make, right? So this is why you need people who are trained.
Yeah.
Right? So that's, right, I still think that's the case, right? I think, right, regardless of where you stand in that dispute,
yeah,
right, I think knowing your own stream of experience is actually a lot harder than people give it credit for.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Even knowing what imagery you're having. So if you think about that image you had of the restaurant, mm-hmm. there are all kinds of questions we can ask about that mm-hmm. that I think are not really easy to answer always, and that you can imagine people going wrong about. You know, like, how detailed is the image?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it kind of fully colored before you mm-hmm. think to, you know, of the colors of the different parts? Or is there some sense in which some of the image is indeterminate in color?
Right.
What is it like for an image to be indeterminate in color?
Right.
Is it kind of flat like a picture?
Yeah.
Or is it more three-dimensional than a picture could be? Right. These questions aren't like super easy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, not at all.
Trailing our thread back, right? So
right.
So part of the scientific challenge of introspection is that introspection, discovering these kinds of, especially maybe the structural features of your own experiences,
mm-hmm.
is at the same time two things. One, really depend on introspective reports, and two, really subject to the kinds of problems and difficulties that introspective reports can have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And often when two people report very different experiences of a, say, a similar stimulus,
mm-hmm.
or in a similar context, it's really hard to know, are they actually having different experiences that they're both reporting correctly?
Yeah.
Or is one of them making some kind of mistake?
Right, right, right.
And how do you settle that? Right. It's very difficult to settle.
Right. That's so interesting. I mean, prima facie, the idea of an expert introspector sounds absurd, right? It sounds as if we're all equally well positioned to introspect. And then with this idea that emerges in German psychology in the early 20th century, it's as if what's being asked for is people who are have been able to train themselves something in the manner of Zen masters who can empty themselves out or who can achieve states that to the normal person seem unattainable. But I would wonder, like, well, what is revealing about the nature of introspection itself if you have to develop this expertise in order to have that sort of experience, right? It's the sort of thing where the untrained person, the unexpert, would seem a more reliable guide to what it actually is.
Right. Well, there are at least two problems with relying on expertise, right? Mm-hmm. One is that the experts might have different experiences as a result of their expertise. So if you think about, you know, say, a Zen master, that person's experience of seeing a tree might be really different from someone else's, especially if they're entering a meditative state first,
right?
And thinking about that experience as it's happening, right? You get a maybe a theatrical version of that experience, so to speak, rather than, you know, the what happens with normal people,
right? Right.
And then, you know, the other big problem is experts have theoretical biases. I mean, I think novices do too, right? Mm-hmm. But that's kind of part of what the imageless thought was often. Controversy was often taken to show, right? That, you know, Kilpa and his friends had a certain theoretical bias toward a certain view, and that ruined their ability to accurately introspect their imagery. Or alternatively, Titchener and his friends had the opposite bias, and that ruined them. You know, experts will be invested in their theories.
Right, right. Now, I don't know the history well, but I gather this is the milieu in Berlin that William James was exposed to, particularly to Wundt, and then he returns to the United States and tries to get psychology going, and it's a psychology that certainly, so, like with James's interest in attention, for example, certainly allows for the first person report to play an important role, but then this gets curtailed or overrun by behaviorism in the 20th century, and it would take almost an entire century more to kind of pick back up again. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I can't recall whether Wundt was in Berlin. Kupa was in Würzburg.
Okay.
You know, so the imageless thought thing is often called the Würzburg school, but
Interesting.
Yeah, I think. Anyway, it is true that James went over to Germany and studied with that group of people. I think it was directly with Wundt. But I'm a little vague on that. But yes, he went over there, learned introspective psychology just as it was starting up with Wundt and his associates. Then came back and wrote his famous Principles of Psychology, which was published in 1890. And that kind of laid the foundation for the growth of experimental psychology in the United States. You know, and in that book, James says, you know, that introspection is the primary method of psychology. Right. So that's right. That's the history. And then in the United States, especially, behaviorism arose in the teens and kind of kicked introspective psychology into the outside of the mainstream of scientific psychology.
Right. It's so interesting. This is such an interesting case where imagining counterfactual scenarios or how history might have, how the theories of consciousness might have developed if history had unfolded differently and different schools of thought had come to dominate. Here's a question, you know, mostly because I'm mostly an early modernist myself. One thing that comes up often for me is when Descartes says, "I think, therefore I am," one of the variants of that. The term is cogito, and I often emphasize that cogito ergo sum might better be translated as "I cogitate, therefore I am," where cogitate is a very special verb, because cogito is a very special verb because it translates a whole bunch of different things, you know, doubting, believing, willing, but also sensing, right? It includes veridical or erroneous sensing, like, you know, what happens in a phantom limb or pricking your finger when you really have the limb. All of this counts as cogitation, right? Because it's something that makes its way all the way into your mind. Now, Leibniz comes along and proposes an alternative kind of key term, which is perception, right? Everything is perception for Leibniz. Some perception is what we would think of as consciousness, namely apperception, right? Perception where you know you're perceiving. But there's also a lot of perception that's just some kind of low-level, dim representation of the many and the one, or however Leibniz describes it. But this raises an interesting question for me, like, how narrow are the bounds of what you, for example, or contemporary philosophers in general would want to call consciousness? Does it include simply, you know, simple perception of a green dot, or does it have to include awareness of the perception of the green dot? Can it include mere sensory perception? You know, where are the boundaries?
Right. That is a question that's, you know, very much debated still. So I think to understand the debate, we probably need to define consciousness.
There you go.
And part of the task here is, what is consciousness anyway? So maybe I can give a version of the standard current definition of consciousness, which I accept. And then use that as a lever into this debate, but then also we can talk about the definition. Right. So I think the typical way, one of the things, I think people who are defining consciousness in this way aren't always explicit that they're doing it this way. But I think this is, if you look at Bloch and Chalmers and Searle, for example, you know, leaders in kind of defining what consciousness is, they all kind of use the same strategy, which is to point to examples. And then also to use certain phrases to illuminate those examples, right? So think about, well, let me start with the phrases, right? To be conscious is to have something it's like to be, right? In the sense that there's Thomas Nagel's famous phrase, there's something it's like to be a bat, but there's nothing it's like to be a stone, unless you accept certain radical panpsychist views or something like that. Think there's nothing it's like to be a stone, but there is something it's like to be a bat. And there's something it's like to be a baby. You know, maybe there's no one thing it's like to be a bat. It could be a whole bunch of things, right? But there's a flow of experience, a stream of experience, to use William James's phrase, right? There's a kind of subjectivity. So for example, if you're, you know, if your eyes are open and you're looking at a ripe red tomato, as philosophers seem to like to do, right? You have you have this experience of the redness of the tomato and its shape. Or if you imagine a tune in your head, you have an experience of the tune. Mm-hmm. Right? If you drop something on your toe, you got an experience of pain. If you feel anger, you got that experience of anger. These are all examples. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So consciousness is the thing, the kind of obvious thing, mm-hmm. that all of those things have in common. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That makes it right to say there's something it's like to see red and to experience pain and to, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, that's the sense. Sometimes it's called phenomenal consciousness, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right? That's the sense of consciousness that's standard in recent Anglophone philosophy, and that I accept a version of that definition. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then you get these questions like, okay, let's suppose we understand consciousness is defined kind of in this way. Right. Is there something it's like to, well, let me put it a different way. Right. So part of what you ask about is how I think of it as the question of how sparse or abundant consciousness mm-hmm, is in the mm-hmm, world. Mm-hmm. So let me give you an example of a case that people have different intuitions about. Right. So let's say that you're driving absentmindedly to work. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking about, say, some unpleasant interaction you had the previous day with the head of the department. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of arrive at your parking lot.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay. Right.
Right, right, right.
Now here's the question, right? Were you having conscious experiences in right. the sense of the road as you were driving, right? Clearly, mm-hmm. you were steering correctly.
Right.
If something had jumped in front of you, you would hit the brakes, right? But that wasn't kind of really in your focus of attention
right.
very much, right? So some people have the sense that, no, you know, probably you weren't consciously experiencing it, you were reacting to it in certain skillful ways, non-consciously.
Right, right.
That would
right.
be the sparse view, right? Where right. the abundant view would say, well, look, you know, it was part of your conscious experience. You were having visual experiences of the road, but mm-hmm. But they just weren't in the center of your experience. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, you forget those experiences that aren't in the center, right?
So yeah.
the center of your experience is, you know, you're thinking about the interaction, right?
Yeah.
So that would be, so that question is highly contentious,
right?
So we get this idea of what consciousness is, phenomenal consciousness, the sense of having experiences, or it's something it's like to be something, right? And then there's this substantive question, do you have that kind of stuff going on all the time outside of attention, mm-hmm. or is it really kind of limited mostly to what's in attention? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you have constant tactile experience of your shoe and your feet and your shoes? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right? Is mm-hmm. that always kind of there at the edge, or do you really not experience your feet and your shoes at all mm-hmm. most of the time until you like, unless there's something going on or you call attention to it?
Right. I suppose here again, being brought up a Leibnizian, I remain strongly attached to the idea of petite perception. So, you know, the idea that you're actually always perceiving everything, not just at the limits of your body. And it's only in special circumstances that this comes into your conscious attention, but that this is a difference of degree rather than kind, which is why perception is the fundamental notion for Leibniz rather than consciousness. But of course, today this is an extremely not heretical, but just an extremely, like, not even on the list of options view.
Right. Right. Yeah, I've always felt Leibniz is fascinating, but so unintuitive and hard to get your head around.
right. Yeah. But no, I mean, the example of feeling your shoe and your foot, it's just like, you know, the example that Leibniz actually does use about, you know that you must be registering every little drop that falls in a cresting wave on the shore if you're, say, a 100 meters away. And you know this because you hear all of them when there's a certain threshold, right? And so it's it follows that that threshold is simply the coming into awareness of something that below a certain threshold remains petit, right? But I'm not going to defend Leibniz today. It's just, it does seem very familiar to these examples you just brought up, and my intuition is that there's no reason to exclude the, let's say, navigational abilities that enable you to drive to work while you're fuming about your department chair or whatever. Or,
my department chair is very nice, by the way.
or whatever, you know, it seems seems like there's no reason in principle to exclude that. And I also, one other comment about what you've said so far, I have sometimes tried when I'm teaching in French to explain the title of Nagel's What It's Like to Be a Bat. And there is a translation in French, and it, you know, it's serviceable enough, but it does not have the same idiomatic punch at all. Mm. And this is a really interesting example to me of where, you know, the reliance on this kind of vernacular definition, what is consciousness? It's what it's like, is really problematic when you think you can't even really render that in a neighboring language.
That's interesting. I didn't know that, but philosophy is so dominated by the Anglophone tradition. I do wonder what survives and doesn't survive when you translate into other languages, and how much kind of mainstream Anglophone tradition is really being hijacked by contingent features of English.
Right. I've actually, this is a side point about me, but that's been one of the most enlightening things about teaching in France. You know, if I'm teaching a text by Sellers or by Ryle or whatever, much of the time is spent kind of explaining these curious English idioms, right? that the authors aren't even aware that they're using. Anyhow, so back to consciousness. So phenomenal consciousness includes then both. I'm thinking of a talk I heard from Ned Block where he was focusing on seeing a red dot. And, you know, he answered a question like, why are you studying something so simple? And he's like, well, because consciousness is so hard, you have to spend a lot of time on these most simple cases. How do you see a red dot before you can get to the more kind of elaborate actual experience that people have? Do you think that's correct? I mean, is that a good methodology? You focus on something as simple as the red dot and then move from there? No, I don't think so.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, some of me is sympathetic with Block about this, right? Because there's a sense in which, right, one of the great things about philosophy is that you can focus on these, in some sense, simplest questions.
Yeah.
What is it for something to exist? And they become so profound in a way, the simpler they are. But I think that in philosophy of mind, this leads us into trouble. So philosophers of consciousness, they almost always think about cases. Their two toy cases are almost always seeing red.
Yeah.
In canonical good lighting conditions where you're looking directly at it with attention, right? Or vivid pain.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Those are the two. That's like what we do. Right. And then, and those are both cases where introspection seems to be to get it right. I mean, like, how could you be wrong about the fact that you're experiencing red when you're looking at that red dot in good lighting conditions? How could you be wrong that you're experiencing pain when you drop something heavy on your toe? Right.
Right.
And then you think, oh, introspection must be really reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If that's your inference base, if those are the two examples you use, you're like, oh, okay, so we're infallible about introspection, or at least very good. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you start with messy, complex examples, like we started with the, you know, the image and the thought about the restaurant,
right?
It's much less intuitive to think that, oh, introspection has to be perfect.
Right.
I think
right.
you get the same thing also when you talk about other aspects of philosophy of mind, like belief.
Right.
When people talk about things like the canonical belief in philosophy seems to be that so-and-so is president, right?
Right.
And that's a belief that's, you know, easily reportable. You introspect accurately. It's got a lot of nice, simple features.
Yeah.
But I think if you start with things like religious belief or belief that all the races are equally intelligent or something like that, and think about what's involved in believing one of those things,
right.
you get a very different picture of the complexity of belief. And it moves you away from these cartoon views that philosophers sometimes fall into when they start with simple examples.
Yeah. Incidentally, so it sometimes seemed to me that someone should write like an encyclopedia of canonical examples used in philosophy, like chalk, tomato, right? Desk, right? Because clearly the kind of availability of these stock examples is influencing the actual content of the theories they're deployed within, right? And if we actually spelled out what these examples are and how they keep coming back, like you're wonderfully doing, I'd never even really thought of these points you've just made, we might learn something. And it would also be pretty funny.
That would be a fascinating exercise. Fascinating.
Yeah. So you're for complexifying things, or you're for taking the hardest cases, because those are the ones that are going to illuminate what consciousness is, right?
Yeah, I think it's important to either start with those or at least get to those pretty early.
Right. And what sort of progress do you feel has been made in that regard in the past years?
I think that there's empirical progress and there's kind of conceptual and philosophical progress. There have been both kinds of progress.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take the empirical side, there's wonderful, I think psychophysics is kind of the best example of progress in consciousness, right? So, and it has a through line all the way back into the early introspective psychologists. What the introspective psychologists really had the most success with was what we now call psychophysics,
right?
Which is looking at the relationships between sensory stimuli and the experiences that those stimuli create, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the color solid, the idea that our color experiences really vary just in three dimensions, right? Their hue, their saturation, and their lightness or brightness, right? It's not kind of like, you might think, you know, that's not obvious.
Right.
You actually have to do some work to figure that out. And that was a great success for the early introspective psychologists, was to figure out that really you can kind of arrange every color experience in a three-dimensional space according to those three dimensions, right?
Right.
So, and psychophysics continued even after the behaviorists kind of kicked most introspection to the sidelines. Psychophysics still continued as a discipline, and it still continues to make progress. We're getting better and better knowledge of the relationships between our experiences of things and the stimuli that create them. There's all kinds of wonderful I mean, just go on the internet and you can find these wonderful, fascinating illusions.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Illusions, of course, depend on introspective report. Right?
Right.
You don't know that there's an illusion unless people say, whoa, that looks like that.
Right. Right. Right.
So we're getting much better at understanding how illusions work and what the mechanisms are under the illusions. And, so I think there's, especially in psychophysics, been a lot of progress in understanding conscious, that part of consciousness empirically.
But this is all now, explaining how consciousness works. None of this gets back to what Chalmers would call the hard problem, right?
Right. That's right.
What it is that makes it possible for you to experience an illusion in the first place.
Right, 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 right. Right. So that's the more theoretical conceptual space. And that, I think what we've done there is we've made progress in thinking through various options.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've made progress in figuring out where the truth lies among those options.
Right, 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 right.
But one of the things that Chalmers did nicely, I think, was knock us out of our materialist complacency.
Right, right, right.
And
right.
I still, if I had to really bet, I would probably bet on materialism, but not confidently.
Right,
right. Right. Philosophers have been doing a great job recently of starting to explore the metaphysical theoretical space of possibilities for consciousness. Like a hot topic recently has been panpsychism, right? The possibility that consciousness is ubiquitous. It's everywhere in the world, right? You even get little bits of consciousness in, say, simple elementary particles.
Right, right.
Or maybe the universe itself as a whole is conscious, right?
Right.
I'm disinclined toward that view, but one of the nice things about recent philosophy is that people have started kind of laying out that view and what it would look like.
Like Galen Strawson.
Strawson and Philip Goff and Luke Roloffs and others. Yeah.
Right. I mean, one thing, this actually connects from the way I see things with the question of AI and the eventual possibility of machine consciousness, because if it turns out that machine consciousness is possible, that would mean that it is substrate neutral, right? That it doesn't require a particular carbon-based evolved biological substrate in order to occur. But if that's the case, then there could be all sorts of substrates that we haven't detected yet, including, you know, at the molecular or atomic or subatomic level, or at the core of the sun, or, you know, any number of different ways consciousness can manifest itself, right? And one thing that's interesting to me is that the kind of hardline view that machine consciousness is just an obvious development of the development of computing technology opens up the possibility of consciousness being manifested in other ways in nature too, right?
Yeah, I think that's true, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, a common view is functionalist, right?
Right.
On which if you've got a system that has certain complex functional interactions, certain kind of information exchange, what exactly, of course, is highly contentious, right?
But
in general, the picture is you got the right kind of functional arrangements among the parts, the right kind of responsiveness to the environment, you'll get consciousness, right? So, you know, then if you got a robot that's got the right functional relationships and the right responses to the environment, it'll be conscious, even though it's made of stuff that's very different from us. But then you might think, okay, well, maybe you, who knows, the clouds of Jupiter, the great red spot, right? Maybe if you really think of, if you figure out what functional relationships are sufficient for consciousness, you might find some of those same functional or informational structures in surprising places.
Right. Now, you and I have corresponded in the past about, I know, about this particular issue of robot consciousness. And you seem to accept functionalism, at least to the extent that you think human-designed machines are on their way to deserving moral status, let's say protections as beings with moral status, which means that if we keep tweaking and improving the way we have put their wires and chips together, at some point they're going to be like, whoa, I exist. am I getting you right?
That is where the majority of my credence is. So I'm broadly skeptical about all general theories of consciousness, in the sense that I don't think we're epistemically compelled to believe one or another theory. But at the same time, I have favorites. Right. I'm not neutral among all theories. Right.
So, right.
You know, if I had to lay my cards on the table, I would be something like a materialist functionalist. But I'm not committed to that being true. I think it's quite reasonable to have substantial doubt about whether robots could ever be conscious. And maybe, you know, maybe the substrate really does matter. That's not my guess or my best bet, but I certainly don't rule it out. I think what's going to happen is that we're going to create robots that are sophisticated enough that it's reasonable for people to think that they might be conscious.
And
some people will reasonably defend the view that they are, while other people reasonably think, no, they're not conscious. So we end up with disagreement and doubt.
I mean, it's interesting, though, also, because there's one sense is that even now, like even if you know the causal history behind the kind of construction of a very realistic looking robot, and you know that it's just running some pretty standard model software and that there couldn't possibly be anything going on in there, you still might feel like only a pretty depraved person would go and, you know, punch it in the face anyway. So it's like, and I think this is part of Dennett's recent arguments about AI and the uncanny valley and so on. We shouldn't be developing human-like robots, not because they're going to have a dawning of awareness, but just because it will confuse our evolved moral comportment towards beings that actually do have awareness. Do you think that makes sense?
I think that does make sense. And you see, Kate Darling has argued for this. She's a roboticist. She's argued basically for exactly that view. And it reminds me of Kant's view of non-human animals.
There's an interesting echo there.
So, you know, Kant said, well, you know, non-human animals don't have any intrinsic moral status. But, you know, you don't go torturing dogs anyway. That says something about you. And
it's a bad sign.
Maybe trains you to mistreat others who do have moral status. So I think there's at least that reason for wanting to not be too cavalier about AI systems once they reach a certain level of sophistication.
And then
the question is whether at some point AI systems might get to the point where there's not only that reason, but there's also some, let's say, intrinsic moral considerability. They have some moral status simply on their own. And that, I think, is plausibly connected to the question of whether they're conscious. So if you imagine that one of these AI systems has experiences, has a stream of experience, there's something it's like to be the system, that it really has pains, it really has emotions, it feels them, it experiences them, and then you torture it, that seems way worse than this kind of mock torture of a system that really has no experiences at all.
But simulates the kind of being simulates it does. It. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. I just had one more question, and then we'll try to come to some kind of denouement about consciousness and personhood, or maybe that's a good way to put it. Man, I keep invoking names of people, and I might be misrepresenting them, but here I go again. I recall talking to Peter Godfrey Smith about episodic memory in non-human animals, and he said something like, "Look, when you kill a cow, you're not depriving the cow of its life. At most, you're depriving it of, say, the next 5 minutes, because the episodic memory is so short that the cow doesn't live its life as the same being from one day to the next, and that this means this is the basis of a moral distinction between what may be done to non-human animals and what may be done to human beings. And this in turn is somewhat connected to something that Dennett says about the way our self-consciousness is kind of the result of constant editorial revisions over multi-track sensory input over the course of our lives, right? Which has a kind of brain-based explanation, but in a sense, what makes us selves is not just that we have consciousness, but that in a sense, we're constantly constructing the story about ourselves that we think of as our conscious memory, right? And so, you know, in a way, I wonder whether consciousness might be, I mean, I should say, I'm very hesitant to deprive cows or even, you know, bacteria, maybe even stones of consciousness. I want to be as generous with consciousness as possible. But on the other hand, there, if we're trying to isolate something that's special about human consciousness, it might be that we have this this capacity to generate self-consciousness by our own what Dennett calls editorial revision. Is that attractive to you?
Yeah, I think we certainly do that more than other species. I don't know much about cows.
Yeah.
I don't know much about elephants either, but
right.
But you know, a little bit about elephants.
Yeah.
Right? They do seem to have long-term memories for individuals and kind of famously when they go to the site where a previous element they were close to dies, they'll fondle the remains and do something that seems like remembering and mourning.
Funerary rites. Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, so I'm not sure I would make, I mean, it's so hard to know, like, what's the reliable sign of an episodic memory, especially one that's consciously experienced in a non-human animal. I mean,
right.
But so I'm not sure about making a really sharp division there, but that humans do it in a richer and more sophisticated way than other non-human animals, that seems uncontentious, I think, and that it's central to ourselves and what makes our lives meaningful also seems quite plausible to me.
Is it central to having something worthy of being called consciousness, or is consciousness something else?
I think that is a form that consciousness can take.
Okay.
But it's not, I guess I'm disinclined to think that you need to be doing that in order to have conscious experiences.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting. I mean, I guess for me, when I read this in Dennett, and it was in kind of a popular piece from Dennett about AI ethics, it really struck me that if you're looking for the key distinction between just bare registering of what's going on in the way that, say, a surveillance camera could do, and what we experience when we register what's going on, is that we're incorporating this into not just a flow, but also what we experience as a stable life history that we call the self, right? So if I were, this isn't really my field, but something tempts me about trying to attach consciousness to selfhood in that way.
Right. That ends up, I think, leading one into a very sparse view of consciousness.
Yeah.
And then it does endorse a sparse view, right? So he thinks there's an open question whether even apes have conscious experience. Right?
Yeah.
So it's sparse phylogenetically.
Yeah, right.
And it's also sparse in terms of moment to moment, right? So we're talking about the absent mind driving case.
Right, yeah.
My understanding of Dennett's view is that he thinks there wouldn't be consciousness going on of the road as you're driving because you're not doing this with it. So it's a kind of functionalist view in that you get consciousness when you have the right kinds of functional relationships among, information processing relationships or cognitive functions or something like that. But the functional relationships that are required are pretty sophisticated. And so you end up not getting a whole lot of consciousness in the universe.
Right. Yeah. Very little. Yeah. I find him so compelling when he writes, but then I step away and I find, wait a minute, but my deepest convictions are entirely at odds with that.
Right. I think it's pretty uncommon to think that, say, a dog doesn't have any conscious experience, that there's nothing it's like to be a dog. But, whether dogs are doing this kind of Dennettian thing, I don't know. I mean, I think they probably have epistemic memory. Episodic memory. But I don't know that for sure. I'm not sure how you test that. They're probably not like pondering, and reconstructing the story of their lives as they're sitting there waiting for you to come home.
Wondering if they've done if they've gone about it all the wrong way.
am I really a good boy?
Listen, I feel like, I mean, one thing that comes to mind as I'm talking to you is I'm just so, so glad this isn't my field. And I only dip in for podcasts and occasional teaching, because I feel like I am just fundamentally stuck in aporia here. That's the result of this episode, is just pure aporia. I still don't know what consciousness is, but I feel like you're well equipped to explain what it could possibly be.
Right. I mean, I'm not so far from that. I think one of the things that that angle that I tend to take in studying consciousness tends to be on the skeptical side about the theories, right? Mm-hmm. So, where most philosophers in the field have their favorite theory that they're plugging for.
Yeah.
What I tend to do is more on the skeptical side and say, here are the reasons to think, not to be convinced by this theory, but to think this other theory might be true, but that's not that I think that theory is true.
Right.
So I'm also to a large extent in a state of aporia about a lot of the issues. Right. Although it's not, I don't think of it as flat. Right. I've got things that I'm more inclined to and less inclined to.
Right.
So I see a little structure in the epistemic space there. But
Right. And that comes through pretty clearly in what you've elaborated here. Before we finish up, can I ask you a quick question about jerks?
Sure.
Tell me what the theory of jerks is.
Right. So a jerk is someone who culpably fails to appreciate the perspectives of the other people around them, including both their intellectual and their emotional perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be someone who, when you disagree with them, they assume they're right and that you're wrong, and they think you're an idiot, right? And
yeah, I love that phrase you wrote somewhere. If you're surrounded by idiots, you're probably a jerk.
Yes, right.
It's a good test.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't. And when people are interested in things or care about things that you don't care about, you just think it's stupid, right? So that's not appreciating their emotional perspectives. Mm-hmm. You see yourself in this world of where you're. I think of this. The concept that I have here is jerk goggles, right? So, right, when you're seeing the world through jerk goggles, you're basically painting everybody around you in broad negative social categories.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Oh, there's this party girl. There's the snob. There's the, you know, this stupid gardener. You know, you just right. You don't appreciate the value and particularity of people.
Right. Is there anything to be said for jerks? I mean, do they have a role to play in society?
I do think they do, right? So yeah. I think there's a kind of self-confidence that the jerk has that enables them to pursue things, right? So if this comes out more clearly, I think, if we contrast the jerk with the opposite, which I call a sweetheart.
Sweetheart
is somebody who is vividly aware, sometimes too aware, of the value and interests and projects of the people around them, right?
So right.
They'll yield their place in line to the hurried shopper, and they'll call you up with an apology for having been unintentionally rude, and they'll seem really torn up about it, right?
Right.
And right. And they'll drop what they're doing to help with what you're doing, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, those people are wonderful, but of course it can become a pathology.
Right.
You go too far that way.
Right.
So the jerk has the kinds of some of the advantages that the sweetheart gives up.
Right.
So I think, like, for example, social movements sometimes are effectively led by people who are jerks because they've got the self-confidence. They know they're right and everybody else is wrong, right? So they'll drive it through, as opposed to someone who's got more nuance, like, well, I could be wrong, you know, I don't know, right? And they're willing to step on other people's heads to get it done because those idiots are standing in the way and they're all wrong and, you know, who cares about them, right? So, you know, they can be very effective leaders, they're better kept at a distance if you can.
Right.
Sometimes they can be very morally motivated, right? They can devote themselves to moral cause. They can even give up their lives for moral causes.
Right.
But it's really about how you perceive the people around you.
Right. No, that's fascinating. And it's absolutely true that this is a character type that's in need of analysis, understudied in earlier work. Though, of course, I suppose it's gone by other names in other moments in history.
Right. Yes, we have so many wonderful names. I think one of the things that ordinary language philosophy has that we still need to recover a little bit is there's such a richness. Mm. And I'd love to see this. We were talking about cross-linguistic stuff, right?
Yeah,
I'd love to see this in other languages too, right? Every language has such a rich assortment of names for moral flaws of various sorts.
Right.
And they have differences of nuance, and they kind of capture different features.
Right.
So you dig into them and you can get interesting things by plumbing the implicit wisdom, I think, in these folk categories.
Right. Absolutely. Oh, that's fascinating. Everyone needs to buy your book, A Theory of Jerks. listen, Eric, it's been really great talking to you about consciousness and other things. And once again, this is What is X? I'm your host, Justin E.H. Smith, and I've been talking to Eric Schwitzgebel about consciousness and what it is. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.